Hey everybody, I want to welcome you to the small group fraternity call today. We're really excited with what's been kind of an annual call with Carl George. Carl's on with us today. It's going to be a lot of fun. And I wish more of you guys had made it today, because you're going to miss out on the opportunity to ask questions and get some insights from Carl. You won't be able to do that if you're not here, but that's okay. And we want to enjoy the conversation anyway. So, Carl, thanks for joining us today. I love this, what's turned out to be kind of an annual chance for us to interact with you on the fraternity call. Thanks for doing this.
You're welcome. It's nice to be with you, Mark.
Well, you know, I speak for the whole crew and with trepidation, but basically I can tell you that all of us really, you know, value the friendship that we have with you. We just love the chance to hear what you're thinking and get some interaction from you about what we're thinking. And I had sent you yesterday, Carl, the link to the Carlos Whitaker blog post. I want to talk about that today. I want to kind of get your take on what Carlos was saying. But kind of to get us started, I was wondering, give us you know, maybe a little update of what you're working on right now, because I know you've got a lengthier, bigger project that you've got going, but you may have several pieces that make up your time and the things that you're involved in. Can you bring us up to speed? What you've been doing these days?
Well, my core activity, of course, is organizational consulting and executive coaching for church leaders that want to grow their churches. That's the thing that I spend most of my time and energy on, because I travel a couple times a month, and that'll take me into anywhere from 2 to 4 or 5 churches in a month, and I'll spend a day or two or three with them. And in the process of doing that, we will go through what they've got going on and where they'd like to be going, and kind of debug the process to make sure that they make the gains and touch the people that they ought to touch. In the process of doing that, you come across some really fascinating stuff. Recently, one of the churches I've been working with had a baptismal day where they had 739 people come forward for baptism that very day.
Wow!
In their 4 services, it was
wow,
utterly amazing. They had about 50 people sign up in advance, but they announced that there would be an opportunity for taking part, and they ordered, on faith, 600 sets of towels to be prepared to handle the situation. But when it got there, it became contagious, and over 700 people. I mean, we're talking about people who got baptized with their street clothes and went home sitting in their cars wet.
That's awesome.
That's the kind of contagion that occurred during that particular day. But
yeah,
when you come across a phenomenon like that, you say, whoa, I want to analyze the sermon. I want to ask what happened the week before. I want to understand what's going on there. And then especially, I want to help the team to manage one aspect of a growth surge. And that is, if you have a growth surge, you cannot go back to business as usual for a year, because you have just been entrusted with 700 brand new people who have made a major step forward in their public commitment, and not to capitalize on that would be a tragedy.
Yes.
In addition to that, the church had picked up a surge of about 500 new people in average weekly attendance in a period of about 2 months, and that means 500 new people to assimilate socially and spiritually within the context of the church. So you've got somewhere between 500 and 700 newly stepped-to-the-plate disciples that need your full-time attention for a time. And a church that will take that seriously will be doing what Elmer Towns used to describe as the necessary plateau before the next surge. He spoke of growth as a stair step. And he said what happens that determine whether a flattening of your attendance is a plateau that's going to lead to decline, or is a base camp for achieving a new summit, has to do with what you do during the time that you get this flat attendance. And after you have a surge of 400 or 500 people in this church, it's running about 5,000 people now. after you have a surge of 10% or 20%, whatever, those people, if you will work to develop leadership among them and to connect them well and what have you, they become the foundation or the base camp for the next thrust or the next stage of growth.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. And you know, I mean, as you share that, Carl, I think back to my time at Fellowship of the Woodlands. Alan, you probably have seen some things like that, you know, both at Brookwood. And Stephen, I know you have. And, you know, what I love about you, Carl, is that you really are a systems thinker. And you're a very analytical person, and you're looking at that. You know, when you kind of hear and see some things that are happening in small group land today, this might be a good opportunity to kind of take that one instance and move the conversation over to group life.
Right.
Where are you seeing that really there's maybe not that appreciation for, okay, you're here now and you've had a surge, what do you do now? Do you see what I'm saying? There's a lot of us, many of the folks who will listen to this recording have been part of what Brett Eastman and Life Together and the Purpose Driven Movement have participated in, which is this notion that you can jumpstart waves of small groups, you know, in a single fall campaign, you know, an effort that might happen off of the September.
And what is important, Mark, about that is that the jumpstarting, the waves of small groups that you start up with basically new leaders, new homes, and new people, is a taste of community. And when it's seen as that, it's a marvelous tool for getting people connected. The idea is not that these people are going to make lifetime commitments to one another in the first round, although some will. The idea is that if they get a taste of community and become familiar with the terms of a small group setting, so they're comfortable within it, then on a successive invitation or a successive wave, they may find themselves with people that there's a good chemistry for. And when that clicks, well, that produces the basis for lifelong friendships. But the idea of introducing people to the protocol of a small group is a tremendously helpful idea. And when they're short-term, they don't carry with them the suffocating feeling of, is it always going to be like this? it turns out to be a true taste of community.
Yeah. Well, you know, what happened, Carl, in the early days of 40 Days of Purpose, which is, you know, where I first saw this, was watching the PD stuff, and what you would see happen in churches everywhere is they would launch a big number relative to the average attendance of the congregation. You know, they may get close to everybody in, but they would have great difficulty sustaining that initial wave. And many of them, I think, threw in the towel, and they just said, "That's, you know, this was fun for the moment, but it really wasn't sustainable."
And that throwing in the towel was a consequence of inappropriate expectations.
Mm-hmm.
See, they weren't taking a longitudinal view of the experience of those people, because experience is cumulative over time. And if they had taken that launch to be successful in and of itself as promoting a positive memory of a good experience, and recognized that those people have stored that memory and it's available to be called on in a future setting, they would have been fine. But when they went in with the idea, well, we're going to launch, you know, 20, 30, whatever groups, and then when half of them or two-thirds of them or three-fourths of them don't want to re-enroll immediately, to call that a failure is just a complete misunderstanding of what's actually going on in the life experience of those people.
Yeah, so you're saying really it's a managing expectations issue.
It's a managing on the part of the leaders. They have inappropriate expectations. They say, we're going to have this new wave of groups, and that's going to enlarge our permanent number of groups by that number, is completely inappropriate. Now, that's not a fault of you guys when you were working with Life Together, because you were saying things like, you know, some percentage of these groups will continue. But
right.
But a lot of pastors are very programmatic, and when they see a thing happen, they want it to continue, however naive that expectation may be.
Right.
It's just experience is going to disappoint them, and then when somebody points that out, they take it as criticism, and then they back away from the experience altogether, and that's sad.
Right. Alan, listening to Carl, I picked up in what he said just then something that we really, I have not personally promoted, is just the benefit of kind of a taste.
Yeah.
When I've talked with pastors around the country, I haven't really talked about that. I've talked about how to sustain the largest percentage of what you launched. And what do you think? Do you hear what I'm saying, Ellen?
Yeah, and I think part of it is early on, you know, pastors are always looking for, you know, the latest new shiny thing and, you know, the silver bullet and all that sort of stuff, like we're killing vampires, right? And I think, you know, one of the things I really had to come to terms with is the idea that people don't grow at the same rate, people don't continually grow, and we have absolutely no control over when that's going to happen. And so I think providing opportunities, and they take the opportunity. For some people, it's the greatest, you know, experience of their life. For other people, it's more of, thank God that's over with. Can't stand looking at that guy on the DVD anymore. You know, so I think it's just continuing on and hoping, you know, or trusting that in all of this, God's going to speak and God's going to move, but it's all in His timing.
We need to trust the serendipity factor. You know, the serendipity factor has been noted in social science for a long time. When I was in graduate studies and I was trying to figure out how joining occurred in groups of all kinds, I wasn't studying churches. I was studying tour groups. I was studying universities, you know, student groups. And in those studies, there was a frequent mention on the part of the researchers of experiences that they had had. Let's say one of the examples stood out in my mind was a tour of some place in the world, maybe it was the Holy Land or someplace, but it was a tour, a bus full of people, and they spoke of this particular tour in which something happened, some kind of an incident that resulted in the hospitalization of one of their members and so forth, and they spoke of the freshness of that tour in their memory years later, and how the tour group had gelled around that shared experience, and that it was enlivening to all of them, and they still remembered it kind of as an alumni group might. Whereas on a similar tour, on another season, no such connections occurred. It was simply relating to the guide and the information, but there wasn't that gelling, that connecting that went on in the earlier tour, and they were sorting out, you know, what were the factors that made one group click and the other group not click. And they concluded that it was not within your ability to cause it. The probabilities were there with any group, but there had to be a combination of circumstance and chemistry for the gelling to occur. And I've observed that through the groups through the years, that you'll have a group that will click. And even if the group dissolves, the friendships continue and persist, and dinner meetings are held 5 and 10 years later with the same set of people. A legacy of relationship survives the dissolution of the programmatic group.
You told me, Carl, about, you know, the connections that you formed in Pasadena.
Yeah.
And, you know, just kind of a network of people that were part of groups you were in there, and you've been gone from that locale for a long time.
15 years or so. My wife was just remorsing the other day the loss of that group. She still maintains a telephone contact with some of those people and thinks of them from time to time very fondly. But that was a strength-giving group. It was just a wonderful group. Because I get more of the story all the time, the layers of that. You know, we were invited to serve as leaders of a group of young marrieds that had nesting stage families. And the real reason that we were invited into that group, if truth be told, was not the fact that I was a professional minister or a Bible teacher or a personality on the pastoral training stage. The reality was that my wife dressed herself and our 6 children and got them to church, and they all looked good, and she apparently managed to smile on top of that, and these other women who had numerous children among them were so amazed by that because they felt so distraught with their own the stresses and pressures of their own households, that they wanted to spend time with a woman who could maintain her sanity and have kids that looked that good. And I was just there as a window dressing to the reality of the conversations those women wanted to have with my wife. Most of us.
I love the notion of Carl George as window dressing.
There you go.
That's a blog post right there.
Our guys hung out together, and we spent a little time talking to each other. But the reality was that the whole thing was driven by the women's desire to share tips on how to raise kids.
Hmm.
Well, and of course, that group, it connected because those moms were at a similar stage in their life, you know. And that's where a lot of the chemistry comes from, is when you have a consonance of values and tasks. A lot of women will tell you of friendships they developed while in the hospital having their children with their roommates who they had never met before and became lifelong friends to.
You know what? Kind of thinking back, Carl, to the Carlos Whitaker post and, you know, the things that he talked about in his blog article this week, it occurs to me that, you know, a lot of the comments and a lot of what Carlos had to say was really referring to a form of group life that is not kind of connection by choice, but it's more of a, you know, it may be some kind of a almost like a mandated experience.
Coercion is the big key.
Yeah,
when I read the Whitaker post, I read all through it, and I thought, oh, you poor people. You have fallen under the prey or the spell of controlling types. You know, there is a type of personality, and that type frequently winds up teaching elementary school, by the way, but they also flock to church staffs who have a desire and a need to coerce others. They know what's right for everybody, and so mm-hmm. they measure everybody's corn in their basket. It's a tendency that we recognize in the scripture as Phariseeism. It's the legalism that comes from doing things my way, which is the right way, kind mm-hmm. of a general bull moose approach to the political process. And you find this in churches all the time. I'm utterly amazed at the degree to which church staff members take a suggestion or a principle or an idea and turn it into a rule, and then beat people up for not meeting it and not allowing any deviations from the rule.
Mm.
That's why I did a whole unit one time on what to insist on, kinda. The idea that if you get a set of principles, are you still with me?
Yeah, but did you actually use the word kind of in the title?
Well, when I narrate it orally, yeah, because that's how it works. You know, here are the never fail, never make exception rule sets, except when you make exceptions. I got it really out of Proverbs. In Proverbs, there's a statement that says, "Answer not a fool according to his folly, lest you be like unto him." And the next verse goes something like, "Answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own conceit." Now you have two contradictory pieces of advice right there. So
yeah.
How do you know when to answer a fool? Well, when you want him not to be wise in his own conceit, and when you want to look stupid while you're trying to argue with him, because there's no winning when you're dealing with a fool. So it's one of those, when do you do it and when do you not do it? Well, you do it with some peril. And I take that approach to principles in small group life. I say, well, look, if you want to have an effective small group, then you have a host home and you have a host. And that gives you the freedom to do what your blog suggested, and that is move the group around a bit. And that's excellent. And then some guy says, yeah, but I've got this big home that I built especially for this group. Then I say, well, then it's not going to work in your case, but what are you going to do when you're out of town? You're going to give somebody else your keys? Or are you going to call the group off? Or no, we'll make arrangements, they'll say. And then what we discover is that they've got expectations and behavior sets, and they're willing to accommodate to some extent, some flexibility. But it's so easy to get rigid. It's so easy to lose the sense of the freedom that ought to be there. And I see, well, I'll tell you, one of the big boosts to small groups at the current time is what's happening in the Southern Baptist world. You know, Tom Rainer wrote the book on simplifying the church, Simple Church, I guess he called it.
Mm-hmm.
And in there, he lays down the dictum that we should have a new three to thrive. You know, the
right.
worship service, a socially connecting place such as a small group or a Sunday school class, and then a service team of some sort. And that's a wonderful combination. But what's happened is some really weird stuff. It's been amusing and amazing to see. I walked into First Baptist Church of Taylor's, and I said, "Do you have Sunday school?" "No, we don't do Sunday school." I said, "You don't? Well, your pastor is a big honcho, former president of the Southern Baptist. How could a Sunday school denomination?" No, we do small groups now." So they hand me this brochure, which is a reprint of their Sunday school brochure, except they struck out Sunday school class and put in life group.
Okay.
The characters are all the same, and the hours of meeting are all the same. They've just retitled everything. And that led in another place to a rumor that the pastor of this church had disbanded Sunday school. So I called up one of the Sunday school teachers, and I said, "What's this I hear about your church not having Sunday school? You've been a Sunday school stalwart since day one." "Oh, yeah," he says, "we still have Sunday school. We just call them small groups now." And I thought, okay, now retitling an existing class structure does not change its social character.
Yeah.
Whatever that class, on-premises control of the church structure existed before you retitled, it is still present with the new name. But what they're trying to do is they're trying to bury the hatchet between home-based small groups and church-based Sunday school classes. And I think the language is helping to do that. But what's happening is the notion of how small groups should be conducted is being altered, because now people with a Sunday school mindset march over to the conformity requirements of Sunday school with them in hand and insist that the home group be run in the same dictatorial fashion. And I think that's unhelpful.
Yeah.
Now, I think it still shows a dependence on the teaching gift as the primary gift in the group.
Yeah. Yeah, it's always nice to have teaching when you've got a primary gifted teacher. What's really tragic is to take a guy who's not a gifted teacher and try to insist that he teach, because that sure messes up stuff.
I've got one group like that still meets on Sunday morning, and it's, you know, one person's doing all the talking, the rest of the group is very passive, nobody will leave the group, nobody likes the group, and the coach said, "What should I do?" I said, "Don't do anything as long as they're tolerating it. When they feel the pain, they'll be motivated to change."
There you go. What you basically do is you green light anybody who comes to you and says, "This group isn't meeting my need. I need to find something better." You help them find something better.
Yeah.
Now, you know, Carl, when you say that, this is interesting. One of the things I've been doing in the last couple weeks is poking around a little bit more in Joel Comiskey's side and kind of reading some of his articles on the cell church idea. And, you know, as I do that, I'm reminded of some, you know, things in Prepare Your Church for the Future and things that you've written over the years. There's a lot of similarity in the conversation, but here's one thing that I picked up on that I'm curious your take, and it kind of is where this discussion right now has to do with this, is the idea that, you know, without these key ingredients of, you know, connection and spiritual growth and multiplication and evangelism, without those key ingredients, it's really not a valid small group. You know, it's really less than what it needs to be without those key ingredients. Came up in several of the articles that Joel has written. And, you know, I contrast that with, you know, the notion that we've been talking about or that we launched the discussion today, which is, hey, it's upside just to get people experiencing a good thing, you know, just to get them to have the beginnings of a sense of connection and a memory, maybe even if nothing more than a memory, a good experience, so that the next time they'll be, you know, amenable to trying it
again.
Well,
there's a challenge always whenever you try to be a program describer. you're going to wind up with some simplification of what's reality. And you're going to say, well, this is kind of the ideal, and you try to strike a balance. But you know, there's a fallacy to all of that. Now, I like Joel Comiskey, by the way, and I recommend his work. Did you see his last book? I put a blurb in the front of it.
Okay.
And so, forth. So, I mean, I'm into Joel. I really like Joel, like what he does. But some of the stuff he picks out of the South American scene are not entirely applicable to every setting everywhere in the world.
Right.
But still, he puts an ideal. He paints you a picture of what a group might be like or what it could include and or should include, whatever. And that's fine. I have no argument because you got to have an alphabet to work with. And I can take a guy who studies Joel stuff and I can, you know, loosen him up a little bit, help him not to be quite so serious about every point. But think about this. If you're going to use the analogy of a cell, and we go to the human body and we look at cells, do you know how many different types of cells have been described in the human body? There's something like 175 different cells in the human body doing all these different things that they do. I mean, it's astonishing. The difference between a blood cell, a muscle cell, a nerve cell, a liver cell, a kidney cell. I mean, when you look at a lining cell, a skin cell, I mean, you go on and an eye cell, the nasal hair cell, an ear hearing whisker cell. I mean, you put the human body together and it differentiates in so many different particulars. What does it have in common? Well, it's all carbon-based life. It's all taking its nutrients from the bloodstream. It's all depending on oxygenation and sugars coming to you from the stomach system and in the intestinal system. But the fact that they share a similar environment and they get something from the body and they produce some effect for the benefit of the other cells in the body, that's the generalization that we need.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can figure out what those pieces are, what those contributions are, what those requirements are, that's where we're on to understanding systems.
Yeah.
That's why in my work I go in and I say, okay, now what does, here's a small group, and what does it need from the body, what does it contribute to the body, and what do we need to do to protect its functioning, its health? What messages does it need? And what people do we need to move in and out, and what does the coaching process need to look like? And so that's why when Myers came along with his book about
about
circuit space and so forth. What's the name of his book?
Well, the most recent one is The Organic Growth, but the previous one, right. The Search to Belong.
Yeah, The Search to Belong. That's the one I was thinking of. When Myers put that together, you know, he did a wonderful thing, and I celebrated that. And somebody says, how can you celebrate that? Because, you know, he's not, you know, tooting your horn. I said, because he's recognizing the uniqueness of people and the differences in individuality and the fact that one particular form or structure may not serve everyone's needs equally well. And I think if we're not that flexible, then we don't have a good enough understanding of what's going on in the social and spiritual structures of a church.
Yeah, there's really, you know, I mean, it's kind of interesting to me, Carl, that as I read books like Joe's Search to Belong, and even Organic Community was fascinating in that it kind of gave a really good perspective about some things that we take for granted. You know, I mean, we kind of come into this small group land or even the need for connection with a perspective. And sometimes look at it so narrowly that we're not really catching some things. So what Joe
I saw something that opened my understanding in one of the churches that I was in. When I interned as a young minister, I was in a church where the executive minister, his name was Verl Ackerman, brilliant guy. He did something at a meeting one time that I thought was life transforming. We had a 4th of July picnic, big Sunday school picnic, and everybody had come and they'd brought out their foods and all. And they were setting them up on tables. And we're talking about, you know, 1,000 people here. We're not talking about just a small picnic. And so we had a lot of people who were not acquainted with each other. And they were setting up their tables the way you'd set up a flea market, you know. I mean, every person's little table was his own area, and they were carefully marking it out, and they had their own foods, and they had their own silverware, and their own cups, and their own... And frankly, there was a good deal of tension around what's mine is mine, and what's yours is yours, and, you know, what's yours is not mine, and vice versa. And I wondered how that was going to be diffused, because the tension was palpable. And Ackerman stood up, and he made a couple of comments, and he welcomed everybody there, and he says, now, I notice that everybody's got their goodies laid out there, and he says, this is really going to be great, because he says, I'm going to spend the next hour, and I'm going to come down, and I'm going to have a bite of everything on every table, and I invite you to all to do the same. And they all laughed, and they had a good time. And I watched the barriers drop with his little announcement, and I saw people smiling at each other and nodding and appreciating and starting to hand out plates and what have you. He gave the prayer, and then they went around, and they had a perfectly marvelous time over what would have been a don't touch my food bowl kind of a guardianship.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, what genius is it that can facilitate that exchange of kindness and food and create a spirit of generosity instantly? You know, what is that? And I started searching for that. And later I categorized that as a facilitating moment. And I began to realize, you know, the average person that is not a super extrovert, not a super salesman, and pastors with charisma, they are.
Mm-hmm.
If they're not extroverted, at least they're super salesmen. They're influential. And they don't have any idea how hard it is for other people to do what they do naturally, meeting strangers, etc. And if we don't have some protocols for facilitation of acquaintance, then people just stay stuck. They stay frozen. Now I don't mean this dumb stuff that I see in so many church services where somebody comes up and says, please pass the peace, or please shake hands with your neighbors, or meet the people around you. That's a little bit of an icebreaker, just enough so you can see the people next to you are disarmed. You know, but that's not acquaintance, but that's the start of it. I mean, facilitating the shaking of hands is an important step. It's a micro step. The facilitating of permission to have a conversation is another one.
Mm-hmm.
The facilitating of, and that can't really be done in a large meeting. It takes smaller meetings to do it. But the idea that we can facilitate the acquaintance-making process by announcing the expectation here is that you will participate at one point or another in a small group setting is a very, very helpful facilitation. And that's something that takes people beyond what they can do. It also gives permission for the leaders of those small groups to inquire about the condition of the souls of the people who attend the small groups, because it's acknowledged that if you're the leader of a small group and you've been deputized by your pastor, you have within that role the ability to say to someone, I'm interested in you, and it's not seen as an inappropriate solicitation. It's seen as an appropriate piece of your role, in the same way that a traffic policeman is expected to wave his arms in the middle of the street, or he's not fulfilling his role, and you accept that behavior from him and take direction from him. So a small group leader that's been named as a small group leader is expected to facilitate conversation, expected to engage, expected to... And that expectation then gives permission to have conversations about subjects that would not normally be legitimate within a typical social contract.
Yeah. You know, I think that's what happens in the launch of a 40 days kind of movement, or, you know, some kind of a church-wide campaign, is we do recruit people. We kind of tap them on the shoulder, or the senior pastor does, and gives them the authority to do this. I think sometimes you made a really great point, Carl, when you said that senior pastors, church leaders, a lot of times don't recognize the fact that what they do so naturally, the folks in the, you know, who actually are persuaded to step up and open their home, they don't really always do those things so naturally. It is a
Absolutely.
Little bit. Yeah, yeah. That's you know, that's the challenge. And Alan talked about earlier the fact that, you know, in the conversion of Sunday school in name only to life group, you know, you still have somebody exercising the teaching gift where, you know, so much of what we've done with what Brett did at Life Together and others have done is try to make it possible for an ordinary person, you know, to host a group and take away some of those inhibitions, but it's still a challenge. Hey,
well,
you guys, I was going to say we have about 20 minutes, and I want to make sure that, you know, others on the call get a chance to ask a question, because I can easily just sit back and listen or ask the dumb questions that I've got. Carl, do you mind? Alan, Stephen, anybody, you guys have a question you want to jump in with?
Yeah, I do. This is Stephen. Carl, as you have, in your work with churches and consulting and everything, what are you seeing emerge on the scene, new strategies or maybe just new ways of doing things that churches are using to help people grow besides small groups? What are the, you know, there's, you've mentioned a couple times in the call that, you know, everybody is so unique, everybody is different, and a one-size-fits-all strategy doesn't obviously necessarily reach everybody. What are some of the other strategies you're seeing out there that are gaining traction to help people really be more intentional in their personal growth and spiritual development?
The strategy, I want to answer your question, and I want to comment on the question itself. But the strategy that's gaining momentum is the use of short-term task groups that service in an outreach capacity towards serving others. That seems to be an almost universal, and it's coming into its own. It's always been acknowledged from classical writers like Lyle Sellers and others that having a place to serve is a very legitimate way of bringing a person into a sense of group membership and ownership, and the privilege of tending the coffee pot or filling the communion cup or handing out a bulletin at a door or whatever. Those are meaningful ways of getting people to feel comfortable in being in a setting. And when you take that a little further to do cleanup for yards for a widow or serving as a big brother for some orphan kid or whatever, or short-term missionary trips to some part of the country that you're unfamiliar with. All of those doing kind of things have a value to not only let people express commitment and identification with the Christian movement, but also give them a forum within which to, a context within which to make friendships that will be enduring. And so I would say that the short answer to your question is some kind of doing activity that engages people.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. In or outside the church, serving others. But there are other dimensions to that. Because the question itself speaks to another issue. You spoke of innovation. You spoke of the early adopter. You spoke of the person who's eager to grow and to be at the head of the line in the pack. And that's perfectly understandable and natural and even laudable at one level. But what I'm finding is the search for innovation is in itself a sickness of its own sort. That is, the search for innovation is what early adopters prize, is kind of their holy grail. But the reality is that the failure to achieve is based on premature abandonment of fundamental processes. You've seen Good to Great, the author, is it Collins?
Mm-hmm.
Why great companies fail. And they analyze all these companies as to, you know, why the ones that were the top companies 10 or 15 or 20 years ago are no longer in the lead. And one of the principles that they discovered was that that they had, in their quest for innovation, prematurely abandoned their core businesses. This is why Vince Lombardi's comments on football are always so astonishing to people when he stands up in front of the top athletes of his selection, and he stands there in front of them and holds the football up and says, "Gentlemen, this is a football. And our purpose is to help you to take this ball from one end of this field down to the other end of that field." And you say, "Come on now, you know, that's so basic." Well, until you've seen a guy pick up the ball and run the wrong way, you don't understand how basic that is. And the fact is, we lose our sight of the ball and the goal. And how we restate our values, and how we restate our goals, and how we freshen them, and how we return to them continually and perpetually, and stay on target, and pursue people and pursue God relentlessly until those pieces are solidly revisited. Innovation is our enemy. It's not our help. Now, how to freshen? You know, that's the quest. Is how do we maintain religious renewal? How can we keep people interested who are so easily jaded by exposure to methods and to processes?
Yeah, Carl. You know, as you answer Stephen, it kind of reminds me, thinking back to the Carlos Whitaker article. You know, is that you can see in the comments that so many people made that they had tried a version of small group life. Yeah. And, you know, they had really probably had a fairly incomplete version that, you know, was what they were reacting to. And,
they had experienced a red blood cell and they were looking for a nerve cell.
Yeah. And so maybe the answer or part of the answer might be, you know, trying new things like more of a task team approach in addition, but equally going back and continuing to make modifications to the way that we're trying to do group life.
Well, see, the quest for renewal is to turn our innovation on refreshing what has been the core value of our group life, whatever that is. And that's where innovation serves you well, is you find a way of interpreting to your people the reasonableness of doing what they need to be doing. It's a refreshing idea.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, the challenge, and I don't know, you know, I don't know the whole situation for Stephen or Alan or, you know, others on the call, but I know from my own perspective, what I really find too, though, is as much as I may need to make incremental changes, I also appreciate the sense that it might be in some completely different innovation, or it might be in some thing that really pushes the boundary far out, you know, that I find what a new concept might be. I think Brett really, you know, was great in our experience. That's where we saw it, you know, is that by lowering the bar and saying you can just open your home and host a group. That was a completely different way of looking at how this could happen.
It was a genius. I'm an innovation junkie, okay? The biggest challenge and criticism ever made of me is I'm always innovating. I'm always trying to find the new stuff. And mm-hmm. and I'm speaking to the value of not losing what we had as we seek ways to refresh. But what Brett got, see, some of the best stuff that's going to come out in terms of innovation is going to be formed in the crucible of experience. I mean, Brett had exactly 1 week, actually 3 days, to create the wave system that aligned the pulpit with the small groups on a fateful week when he got to Rick Warren's place. And Rick bought it. He bought it between Wednesday and Thursday on a particular fateful week. And they said, "Hey, we can do this." And they changed everything instantly, put it in gear, whoomp, they took another step forward, and they wound up with the 40-day stuff. The genius there was recognizing this innovation was worth capitalizing on. It's where you're going to take advantage of this because here he had something that had a little spark in it, and he said, "Whoa, this is good. We can do this over and over. We can do this in other forms." And he immediately set by revisiting that success until it became a more or less standard method of a launching. See, we'd known for a long time that the pulpit carried weight.
Mm-hmm.
What we didn't have was DVDs to be able to carry the pulpit home and put it in the living room and touch the recorder. So there was a technique involved, technology
true.
Involved.
Definitely, that was a kind of a game-changing innovation. Kind of reacting to that now, I think, my personal take is that the next piece to that might not be the fact that we can stream it on the web. It may be that the group itself could be not in the same room. Somehow, an online experience could be the next thing that would still form real community. I don't know what you think about that, Carl, and I want to be sure that I give Alan others a chance to ask a question before we jump from where we're at. You guys have a follow-up to Stevens or to another question? All right. Carl, we've got about 8 minutes left here. And, I don't know if you have something that you want to share with us as we wrap up, or if you want to maybe come back and I would love to get your take on the idea that you could have online community. I don't know what you've had in the way of experience with that, or
you're living it right now. You're in online community right now, even though you're using the telephone instead of voice over IP. I'm actually using voice over IP to speak to you because I have a Vonage subscription, but the technology is here for us to have conference calling,
right,
which is a form of virtual community. We're living into it. And the value of it is enormous. Now, you don't get the subtle clues. You can't see somebody wince or grimace. You can't see somebody respond negatively. You can't see somebody get enthusiastic. It's a more difficult environment because you don't get the clues you get when you're face-to-face.
Right.
But if people have met themselves, or if they have learned about each other, or they have experienced each other, then that environment is a continuation environment. It's very enriching.
Right.
The research shows us that outliers are the most likely to use virtual community as opposed to people who can have face-to-face meetings.
That's an interesting thought. And actually you share another thing. The groups that I've seen do it, and Alan, maybe I don't think you've been in on these, but I know Boyd Pelly and four or five other, fairly well-known small group folks, Willow's, Dave Treed and Alan Danielson and a few other guys like that have had an online group that they've done on TalkBox. And but Carl, what you're saying is one reason that may work is that they already know each other. They've been, even though they're separated by many miles, they know each other pretty well enough to where
I can do. Here's the rule that I follow. I can do a one-on-one with you and get pretty good. But when I try to involve more than one-on-one, if it's two or three or four people, if I don't know who they are, I'm lost. I need to have been with them in group to appreciate the virtual community aspect. I can talk one-on-one to any one of them, and that's helpful. And if I've had enough time with them on one-on-one, I can gather them. But it's really tough to pitch into a virtual community, in my experience, by wading into it. I have some virtual community software that I use that fairly regularly that works for me, and I can send you a sample of it if you ever need it. But that helps because I can have up to 25 people in the room and see them, and we can talk back and forth, and everybody can see and hear, and that's kind of nice.
Okay,
but,
now that
the tools are not quite
Talkbox,
fluent enough yet.
TalkBox is very similar to that.
What's
a free TalkBox, T-O-K, VOX.com is very much like that. The screen can. I've seen the Seacoast experience where they had I think something like 60 plus people on the screen.
Yeah.
And you know, each one kind of represented. So it is an interesting thing to see it demonstrated, and it's also interesting to think about you running groups like that. That would be fun to do this call in that way sometime.
Yeah.
We can try that again. Well, we're just about out of time here, and anybody have a kind of a wrap-up question that you want to throw out to Carl before we sign off here today? I think they're in stunned silence because they've asked some good ones. Carl, you actually have led the way with some ideas that, listening to the recording later, I'm gonna have to probably write on two or three of the lines that you used, because there were some things that you talked about throughout the call that very helpful ways to think about everything from kind of a managing expectations view. I think that's very helpful for the folks that will listen to this recording later. Thinking about the value of just that preliminary experience, or that beginning experience, is great. It is a great insight. So listen, I'm going to go ahead, Carl. I love the fact that you've given us an hour of your time and that you've been part of this call today. Thank you so much for joining us.
I like your Mark Howell Live.
Well, thank you for the plug, and I wish I could get you writing in that way. Maybe I could persuade you to give me a guest article, and I could put it on there from time to time, and then it could be Carl Live on Mark Howell Live.
There you go. Thank you.
Great. Well, thanks, Carl. Thank you very much for being on. Hey, everybody, we're going to be back in the new year with some folks that we are confirming right now. Our first call in January is actually not the first Wednesday, it's the second. And I'll be back to you with that detail, and you'll see it posted in the coming days. Thanks, everybody. And Carl, thanks again for joining us. You guys have a great December, a great holiday, and a Merry Christmas. And I hope that the year finishes up well for you.
Thank you.
Bye now, everybody.
Thanks, Carl.
Thanks, Carl. Thanks, Mark.